Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 113, Flowers in the Attic.
Some people have ordinary childhoods, but ours was truly unforgettable. We were tucked in every night, behind closed doors that were always locked.
Your dad's gonna be home in less than 2 hours. He's gonna be so surprised.
I'm sorry, but there's been an accident.
She's got a smile that it seems to me.
We can go live with your grandmother.
You and Dad said we never had any family.
My family is unbelievably wealthy.
We don't like it here.
Don't make your grandmother angry, okay? Some mothers are impossible to love.
Make the rules in this house,
and I execute the punishment.
Now and then, when I see a place,
I think I'm pretty.
To that special place, but if I stare too long, probably.
Can you ever forgive us?
Oh, sweet child.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. Here I am, trapped in an attic with someone with whom...
You really want to go there.
No, let's consider an alternative. Here I am at a donut shop, contemplating whether or not I should get a powdered donut or a glazed donut. And the person across the counter encouraging me to get the glazed is my good friend, Tom Panarese.
There. Hi. How are you?
Oh, I'm well. Thanks for saving me from going down a dark path that we could not return.
No.
Well, we finally have done this novel, and I asked off air if you recovered and you escaped from the attic, and what was your response?
I don't remember what it was, but basically I tell you I will never eat a powdered donut again.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are so many shocking moments, but I think that one did make me gasp out loud, because that you see all these other things going towards a certain way, and also this novel has quite a reputation, so I knew some of the big beats, but that I did not expect, actually.
And then it starts to add up once you find that out, and you're like, you start thinking back, you're like, so all right, well, we'll get to that, I guess.
Yes, indeed. And we'll ask the question about, I think it's revealed later, but from this, without knowing who did it, was giving the donuts, because I think that was equally shocking. But yes, so we're finally doing Flowers in the Attic. The reason why I picked this, as I mentioned at the end of the previous episode, is because we've mentioned it several times in sort of a joking way. And I feel like unless you have actually experienced something, maybe you shouldn't be allowed to reference it. And so I felt it was time so that we, you know, could keep our respect box high. And so we finally did it. And also flowers are becoming to be in bloom-ish. I mean, we had this weird I think Virginia as well as Maryland had last week, like it went up to 80, or 2 weeks ago, it was like up to 80. And then there was a blizzard the next day. And then, you know, but I think we've actually entered, I guess, towards spring. What is your history with Flowers in the Attic?
Oh my God. So this is actually my first time ever reading the book, but my grandmother had this when I was a little kid. She had all of them, all the V.C. Andrews books. And I remember them very vividly, really not because of like what they were about. I don't think I found out what they were about for years later. But now my copy and your copy probably doesn't have this, but the V.C. Andrews books were unique. At least they kind of started the craze of die cut covers. So you would have like the cover here. We have like the attic of the house. Or in the case of one of the sequels, which is a Garden of Shadows, it's like a trellis with a bunch of roses on it and a girl's face like in the middle of the circle. And if you pull back the cover, it reveals like a whole portrait or something. And, you know, here I am, this little kid, and I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool, you know, like. And so I always kind of like knew these books were around and stuff. And I always kind of paid attention to what my parents and my dad, my grandma, like were reading back in the 80s. So they read, my grandmother was reading this. Her and my father were reading Gene Auld's Clan of the Cave Bear saga and then Stephen King and stuff like that. And it wasn't until years later, I found out what this was about. My wife was telling me, you know, my wife and I have had conversations over like inappropriate books we read as as kids. And she said she had read this. She'd also read like Hollywood Wives or some other Jackie Collins novel, whereas I was reading like It and other inappropriate stuff because, you know, they were there and our parents like weren't really paying attention. And the funny thing is with Flowers in the Attic, for so many women I know who are of my age and slightly older, it's kind of the same story. Like this was kind of the book that you cribbed from somebody and you read it and it was like kind of lurid and illicit. So it's kind of became this rite of passage in like later day Generation Xers as tweens and teens. And having read it, I get why my grandmother had read them, because my grandmother loved soap operas. I know she watched The Guiding Light, and I think she might have watched a couple of others. And this is very soap opera, you know, kind of with the crazy twists and turns and stuff like that, especially as you get into the later books. So yeah, and it just became kind of a running thing. In fact, over on Blue Sky, about a week ago, I posted just a shot of Kathy's picture in the attic with the caption, "When your podcast co-host is clearly trolling you."
Oh.
And my friend and poet V.C. Myers responded, "Oh, you just took me back to junior high in one image." So we've all got that. And I told my wife, she's like, "Why are you doing this?" And so I said that you did this to me. And so I told her when I finished it, I was just like, "What is this book?" And she said, and I was trying to like, I was giving her my review. She's like, "Oh yeah," like and such. So she kind of had a laugh about it, but she has the experience of having read this at a inappropriate age as well. So it's kind of fun to have finally read this because I'd heard so much about it and has such a reputation.
Yeah. It's also funny, your friend's name is VC as well.
That's her, like her nom de plume. It's her first name is Victoria. And I want to say she probably, I'd have to ask Vic if she did it, but I want to say she probably did that on purpose.
Well.
Yeah. Her first two initials though are B and C. So, but I just, yeah. Oh, and one other side note is that I actually learned a little bit more about V.C. Andrews through Grady Hendrix, the horror author, because Grady Hendrix published a book a number of years ago called Paperbacks from Hell. And it's all about like horror novels from like the 60s all the way up to about the 90s. And because there were so many written and produced, and he does a chapter that is about Gothic horror. And it starts off with V.C. Andrews and then Anne Rice. So he wrote about her. And I saw at the festival of the book in 2019 or so, I think, he did a reading from paper, a whole, he actually, no, he did like a whole PowerPoint from about paperbacks from hell. And he told some of the stories about V.C. Andrews, and I have my copy of the book signed by him. So this has kind of followed me in some weird way over the years. And so I was, as groaning as I was kind of excited, just like let's do this, challenge accepted about it.
See, look at that. I'm helping you grow as a human.
I wouldn't put it that, I wouldn't go that far.
Oh boy. It's interesting you call it a gothic horror. I guess that's something we can consider in terms, or a question we could think about in terms of genre. Cause it's, for me, it's hard to sort of put my finger on what the actual genre is.
Yeah. I think it's got elements of that gothic.
I would agree. Yes. I think the issue that I would have trouble getting over is that it's very clear that, you know, there are bad people, and you, mm-hmm. it's not like there's a specter or something that's kind of gone around, or you have like many mm-hmm. questions, because I feel like there's always this element of what's happening. But yes, my history, I'm trying to think of when the first time was that I heard of Flowers in the Attic. I don't know if I saw a Lifetime trailer and was like, what's this? Mm. I mean, it might have been when I was an older teenager, potentially. And I know that I didn't get the chance to, though I'm kind of interested in watching the newer film that has Kiernan Shipka as mm-hmm. Kathy, because I think it's free on Tubi. But I remember seeing that, and as some of you are aware, I do have a fondness for step sibling romances, but this is a bridge too far, I'm afraid. So once I found out what was really going on, I was like, oh, maybe not. But it is certainly fascinating in terms of there is something that pulls you out of maybe a sick interest, kind of like how you want to be looking at a car crash for some reason when you're driving by to figure out what's going on. A sick interest in this like story that is pretty, I mean, I don't know if depraved is too harsh or it's harsh enough, but also the sequels get even more unhinged. We could also use that particular word, but they do very much, I think, and were back then, you know, frothing at the mouth. And then if I ever mention it to somebody, they immediately have usually someone of that generation that was, you know, buildings Roman, up and coming during the time that this came out, they do have a very particular reaction to it. And like, oh, you know, we were reading that. Just like, I guess, your first romance novel where you're, you know exactly the pages you need to go to and you have them yeah. here, et cetera, that sort of thing. So it has been interesting to finally dive into what this novel was. And if all I really knew was about, I knew that a twin died, or a child died, I should say, because I don't know if I knew that it was a twin necessarily, and then that these two siblings had a relationship. That's basically all I knew. But the extent of it, I mean, it was very grossing, but also it was borderline almost too much, because I was just like, this is what's happening here. Yeah. Also, the way it's presented to you by other people, as well as I think mainstream media, is that it is a romance between yeah. Kathy and Chris, but which we'll talk about. I mean, it very much is a sexual assault.
Yeah.
So I was ill prepared for that, because I thought,
so was I.
Yeah, I thought it was a consensual relationship, which doesn't necessarily change much, but having it be an assault, I think, greatly changes it. So. Yeah, so very interesting. And yeah, I'm looking forward to diving into this little guy. And now we can say that we read it.
Yeah.
So, and it's up to you if you want to keep reading them. I read this.
It's up to the audience.
Yes, it is up to the, we will not probably, yeah. I don't think I would pick any more. I will say that I went to see Moulin Rouge this past weekend, because it's one of my, yeah, I love that movie. And it was closing on Broadway and I had not had a chance to see it. And I thought, thought, let's do it. And we might have mentioned, or if you've listened to any of my shows, Professor Carolyn Coca, she lives up in upstate New York. And so I got her to come down and I mentioned this book, that we were doing this book. And so she had one of those stories. And then I was just asking her questions about, like, who gave the donuts? Do Chris and Kathy, are they like together at the end? That sort of thing. You know, what is the end result of all this? Mm-hmm. And during intermission, we ended up speed reading the rest of the synopses, and the amount of paralyses that happen is a bit ridiculous. Like, more than one person getting paralyzed is a bit ridiculous.
And then there's, I can't believe you were able to speed read them, because they're if you go on the Wikipedia pages for all of these, I think, like, I want to say all the V.C. Andrews novels, but I only read the five, and then the synopsis of My Sweet Audrina, which is a totally separate novel. They're not short. No. And they are very convoluted. You're just I could, I have fun. By the way, listeners, later on, after we're done with our discussion, but before the feedback section, I will do a quick run through of, like, kind of bullet point synopsis of the other four books in the main series of what's called the series of, like, the Goth Dahlenganger or Dahlenganger family, just in case you don't want to read the remaining books and want to find out what happened to the characters. Mm-hmm. But if you do, after hearing us talk about this, you are welcome to skip those few minutes of audio.
Yeah, there you go. I'm interested to see how Tom does it, because, like I said, it would get super convoluted. People die and yet come back from the dead. Relationships, interrelationships. It gets nuts, I'm telling you. And I read comics, so.
So do I.
Okay, well, let's get into V.C. Andrews herself. She is better known as Virginia C. Andrews, and she is an American novelist best known for her 1979 novel Flowers in the Attic, which inspired two movie adaptations and four sequels. While her novels are not classified by her publisher as young adult, oh boy, that'd be, I'd be scared, I guess, if my freshmen were reading this. Other young protagonists have made them popular among teenagers for decades. After her death in 1986, a ghostwriter who was initially hired to complete two unfinished works has continued to publish under her name. So she was born in Portsmouth, Virginia, the youngest child and only daughter of Lillian Lenora Parker, a telephone operator, and William Henry Andrews, a tool and die maker. She had two older brothers, William Jr. and Eugene. Andrews grew up attending Southern Baptist and Methodist churches, which might create some inspiration within this particular book. Who knows? As a teenager, Andrews suffered a fall from a school stairwell, resulting in severe back injuries. The subsequent surgery to correct these injuries resulted in Andrews suffering from crippling arthritis that required her to use crutches and a wheelchair for much of her life. However, having always shown promise as an artist, she was able to complete a four-year correspondence course for her home and soon became from her home and soon became a successful commercial artist, illustrator, and portrait painter, using her art commissions to support the family after her father's death in 1957. Later in life, Andrews turned to writing. Her first novel, written in 1972, entitled Gods of Green Mountain, was a science fiction effort that remained unpublished during her lifetime, but it was eventually released as an ebook in 2004. In 1975, she completed the manuscript for a novel called Flowers in the Attic. I wrote it in 2 weeks, Andrews said. The novel was returned with the suggestion that she spice up, that's in quotes, and expand the story. In later interviews, Andrews claims to have made the necessary revisions in a single night. Tom, what are you doing? The novel, published in 1979, was an instant popular success, reaching the top of the bestseller lists in only 2 weeks. Every year thereafter, until her death, Andrews published a new novel, each publication earning Andrews larger advances and a growing popular readership. By 1982, her horror novels had sold more than 11 million copies. Quote, I think I tell a whopping good story, and I don't drift away from it a great deal into descriptive material, end quote. She stated in Faces of Fear in 1985. Quote, when I read, if a book doesn't hold my interest in what's going to happen next, I put it down and don't finish it. So I'm not going to let anybody put one of my books down and not finish it. My stuff is a very fast read, end quote. in an interview for Twilight magazine in 1983, Andrews was questioned about the critics' response to her work. She answered, "I don't care what the critics say. I used to until I found out that most critics are would-be writers who are just jealous because I'm getting published and they aren't. I also don't think that anybody cares about what they say, nor should they care." Andrews died of breast cancer on December 19th, 1986 in Virginia Beach, Virginia. After her death, her family hired a ghostwriter, Andrew Niederman, to finish the manuscript she had started. He would complete the next two novels, Garden of Shadows and Fallen Hearts, and they were published soon after. It was adapted into a film of the same name in 1987, starring Louise Fletcher, Victoria Tennant, Christy Swanson, oh my gosh, and Jeb Stuart Adams, and directed by Jeffrey Bloom. A second adaptation was released on January 18th, 2014 on Lifetime, starring Heather Graham as Corinne and Ellen Burstyn as the grandmother, with Kiernan Shipka as Kathy, Mason Dye as Christopher, and directed by Deborah Chow. The film received mixed reviews, but critics praised Ellen Burstyn's performance. The book was also adapted into a stage play, which was written by the ghostwriter, Andrew Niederman. And then there was a limited series, again, Lifetime, 2022, called Flowers in the Attic, The Origin, starring Kelsey Grammer and Kate Mulgrew. Who even knows what that would be like? I am sure I could find this stuff. The four-episode miniseries is a prequel that focuses on Olivia Foxworth and is largely based on, who is the grandmother, and is largely based on Garden of Shadows, the fifth novel of the Dahlenganger series. In a pitch to her publisher, Andrews claimed that the story behind the novel was, quote, not truly fiction, end quote, leading to longstanding rumors that the novel may have been based on true events. And there's actually a question I have about that and her mother. So we'll get to that. For many years, no evidence was found to support this claim, and the book was passed off as fiction. Nonetheless, the official V.C. Andrews website claims to have contacted one of Andrews' relatives, and this identified relative claimed Flowers in the Attic was loosely based on a faintly similar account. While at the University of Virginia Hospital for treatment, she developed a crush on her young doctor. He and his siblings had been locked away in the attic for over 6 years to preserve the family wealth. So could be true, or could be, you know, a way to sensationalize and create more stir and all of that.
I will say that, like, one of the most surprising things about this book was that it takes place here. Oh, in Charlottesville.
I know.
Right outside of Charlottesville, because they go to the train they mentioned. So I was like, wait, what? And then at the end, they head back towards Charlottesville. So it's like and they said the foothills of the Blue Ridge. So it's like out in like Crozet, or like out in like the western part of Albemarle County. I'm like, I literally live in the same area where this book takes place, and I did not know that.
You might know the Dahlengangers.
Maybe I do. Maybe I teach those kids. I don't know. All right.
Well,
back to
the kids' kids, I guess. Yeah.
I guess so.
Reception-wise, a review in the Washington Post when the book was released described the book as deranged swill. That may well be the worst book I have ever read. The retrospective in The Guardian agreed that it is deranged, but called it utterly compelling. And now there are school book bans, as is, you know, who we would always expect it, I would say. The depiction of incest between an adolescent brother and sister in the novel has led to its being banned multiple times. Shario High School in Rhode Island removed it because it contained, quote, offensive passages concerning incest and sexual intercourse, end quote. In 1994, it was removed from the Oconee County, Georgia school libraries due to, quote, the filthiness of the material, end quote. And then finally, awards. In 1993, Flowers in the Attic was awarded the secondary Bilby Award. No idea what that is. I should have looked that up. In 2003, the book was listed on the BBC's The Big Read poll of the UK's 200 best loved novels. So even though people may say that it is deranged swill, you're still reading it and people still have fond memories of it. So let us all remember that. Anything to add?
No, although I'm surprised school libraries bought it to begin with.
They must have only because of the popularity.
Possibly, yeah. But no. So go right ahead into the...
the plot synopsis.
Plot synopsis.
Oh, get pumped, everybody, for a Just a joyous ride.
Oh, yeah.
Rainbows and unicorns and sunshine. Mm-hmm. Okay. In 1957, the Dahlenganger family, father Christopher, mother Corinne, 14-year-old Chris, 12-year-old Kathy, and 4-year-old twins Carrie and Corey. Yes. They, in fact, all have C names in a nice little alliterative pattern. Live an idyllic life in Gladstone, Pennsylvania, until Christopher Sr. dies in a car accident, leaving Corinne in debt with no means to support her children. On the verge of their home being foreclosed, Corinne reveals to the children that as a young woman, her marriage to Christopher so offended her multimillionaire father, Malcolm Foxworth, that he disinherited her. Now, the elderly Malcolm is dying of heart disease, and Corinne intends to return to her childhood home of Foxworth Hall in Virginia to win back his affection in time to be reinstated into his will. Because Malcolm is unaware that Corinne had children by her marriage to Christopher, the children must hide in a secluded upstairs room of the enormous Foxworth Hall until Corinne can break the news to her father. She assures the children that they will only be in the room for a few days. At Foxworth Hall, Corinne's mother, called only the grandmother, locks the children in a bedroom connected to the house's large attic. The grandmother forces Corinne to reveal to her children that the reason for her disinheritance was that Christopher Sr. was Malcolm's younger half-brother, thus Corinne's half-uncle, and that the children are the products of incest. The grandmother believes the children are the devil's spawn, and is obsessed with the idea of incest, forbidding all contact between opposite sexes, while prohibiting the children from making noise or opening the room's windows. Only in the attic are they free to play. Chris and Kathy attempt to make the best of the situation by decorating the attic with paper flowers to create an imaginary garden for the twins. The grandmother comes every morning with a picnic basket filled with the day's food and interrogates the children about their modesty and piety, questions the children are too innocent to understand fully. Initially, Corinne visits several times a day, bringing toys and gifts, but over time her visits become sporadic. After months have passed, Chris and Kathy confront her as she promised they would be freed in only a few days. Corinne finally confesses that they must remain in the room until their grandfather dies. A year later, Chris and Kathy have both entered puberty. I feel like Chris was already in puberty. But while the twins are stunted from inadequate nutrition and lack of sunlight, with no other outlets, Chris and Kathy develop a romantic and sexual attraction toward each other, though they do their best to deny their feelings. The grandmother catches Chris staring at a half-dressed Kathy and punishes the children by cutting off their food supply for over 2 weeks while they pray their mother will reappear in time to save them. On the verge of starvation, Chris and Kathy decide to escape with the twins to find help. Before they can go, though, the grandmother begins bringing food again, including a rare treat of powdered sugar donuts. Soon afterwards, all the children begin to complain of constant minor illnesses. I think that is also the time, it didn't note this in the synopsis, but I think that it is a big point that she cut off their food supply and said she wouldn't feed them until Kathy cut off all of her hair.
Yeah,
because she blamed a lot on Kathy's vanity as well. Mm-hmm. And then Kathy does it because they're kind of going to, they feel like they can wait her out. And then the grandmother puts tar on her head.
Yes.
So just because, you know, I just want to make everyone aware that this is a pretty intense novel. So, So there you go. Another year passes. So this is year two. After an absence of several months, Corinne visits the children, explaining that she had been on a European honeymoon with her new husband, Bart Winslow, who will appear in future novels. Chris and Kathy are furious, but fear Corinne will abandon them permanently if they confront her. I was just thinking, I feel like Chris fears that more than Kathy does, but we can talk about that. Realizing that the twins' health is declining, he and Kathy decide to escape. Chris creates a wooden skeleton key. Over the next several months, he and Kathy take turns slipping downstairs to their mother's suite to steal cash and jewelry to fund their lives outside. One night, Kathy comes across her sleeping stepfather and kisses him. And this comes back in future novels. When Chris learns of the kiss, he rapes Kathy in a fit of jealousy and rage. Afterwards, he is overcome with remorse, while Kathy feels guilty and conflicted about the act due to her love for Chris. One of the twins, Corey, becomes deathly ill. Kathy begs Corinne to take him to a hospital, but Corinne hesitates. Enraged, Kathy tells her that if she does not act to save Corey's life, Kathy will reveal their existence to the grandfather. Corinne finally takes Corey away, but returns the following morning to inform the children that he died of pneumonia. The children are, and is already buried. It was very quick. The children are devastated, with Kathy left wondering if Corey's death is God's punishment for her sexual assault by Chris. Chris resumes stealing from their mother's rooms, only to discover that Corinne and Bart have left Foxworth Hall permanently. I think a key detail, eavesdropping on the servants. Chris learns that their grandfather died a year ago and that the grandmother has been leaving food contaminated with rat poison in the attic due to a mouse infestation. He connects this with the donuts they are being fed and realizes that Corey died of arsenic poisoning. The three remaining children now you might be asking yourself, why didn't everyone die? And during the time of starvation, as well as other times, Kathy would often give up her own donut and give it to Corey. And that might be true of Chris as well. So they were definitely giving it to the littlest ones. So that's why he was getting heavier doses than other people. Just FYI. The three remaining children finally leave Foxworth Hall to catch a train to Florida. At the station, Chris reveals that he discovered that Corinne's inheritance is conditional upon her having no children from her first marriage. And Corinne, rather than the grandmother, was the one who most likely poisoned them. Chris and Kathy decide against contacting the authorities as their main concern is to stay together. But Kathy vows that one day she will make Corinne pay for her crimes. And I will say that I think we'll talk about the future because, Chris has a lot of he has more optimism, I think, than Kathy does. But Kathy is a dancer. So there's a bar, I would say, that Chris helped set up in the attic. So she practices a lot and she wants to be a dancer, a performer. And Chris really wants to be a doctor because there's a lot of like sitting time with this novel of like just daily mundane things. And so you get to know who they are and figure all of that out. So I think that gives most of it. I'm sure as we talk, we'll also fill in the gaps, but that just sort of gives you an idea there. Yes. Okay, Tom, did you like Flowers in the Attic?
This is tough because I don't like to crap on novels, but the plot intrigued me at times because I was kind of wrapped up in the, like, the whole time I'm like, something's up with the mother. As it kind of went on and on and on, I was like all the things that I had thought was happening with Corinne were like proven correct. It's really tedious. The narration kind of got to me sometimes because it's narrated from Captain's point of view, but she's like, she's constantly using the word mama and honestly, it's not that good of a book as far as being well-written and everything. That being said, I totally see why this was popular, because not only is it lurid in places and it's very provocative and stuff like that, but at the same time, so this was published in 79. 79 is like right in the smack in the middle of like the golden age of soap operas. Right. Like where people were watching all the daytime soaps, like in the millions. 2 years after this was published, General Hospital would have a 2-episode wedding of Luke and Laura, which were like the original or the epitome of the soap opera power couple. And I was looking up this today because I just wanted to make sure that I had it right. It was 1981 and 30 million people watched it. And that's like the highest rated audience ever for a soap opera. So Andrews tapped into, I guess the word zeitgeist is like the best word to use here. And so I totally see why this was so popular, because it's so soapy, as are the sequels from what I've read of the thing. I can see why this became this rite of passage for my generation, because again, it's like grandma had it, maybe mom had it. They watched the stories and everything. And like, you're kind of peeking into that adult world and stuff like that. But as a standalone book, it's not that great. It held my attention, but if I was rating it on a scale of 5 stars, I'd say like about a 1.5 or 2.
Wow. That's pretty low. Mm-hmm. I will say I find it entertaining. Mm-hmm. And I think we've we've both encountered this idea of, yeah, liking and all of that stuff. And so I can appreciate where it is in terms of pop culture, I would say, and its place in literature and sort of the history of literature and everything. Yeah. I feel like it's better than 50 Shades of Grey. So I do wonder what that Washington Post reviewer would say about 50 Shades. I've never read 50
Shades.
I haven't either, though. I have like skimmed certain passages.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some passages.
Yeah. And like the prose and everything, it just doesn't. So I will say that it's better written than that. I think it, for the most part, gets you hooked. Like you're wondering what's going on, but it just, and it's also one of those things where you think it can't possibly get worse and it does. So it's like, it's just very dramatic and gripping in that way. But I will say that because they're in there for 3 years and you wonder like, to what extent do we need to be going into these mundane every day? Like this is what it is. Cause it does get repetitive. I agree with you on there. Mm-hmm. So it held my attention, but I would say maybe I lean more towards I didn't care for it than I did care for it, to be honest. Though at least I can say I've read Flowers in the Attic and can talk about it with people. So
yeah,
because that's what I appreciate about literature is you can have a discussion about it.
Yeah. When I was talking to my wife about it and I said, she was like, oh yeah, it's a terrible book. and it's not well written. And I did say to her and she's like, I think about this all books. And I wonder if you would agree with me. This book could have been about 50 to 100 pages shorter and it probably would have been a little bit better.
Yeah.
Cause then I think it's the mundanity of the time in the attic because, you know, once kind of the real tension gets ratcheted up and like maybe the back half of it, I was reading it a lot more quickly, but I would say the first 100 to 150 pages were a struggle for me to get through at times.
Get the setup. Yeah. I guess in a meta sort of way, she is able to replicate what it would be like in the attic.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Because this is, you know, they go through the same thing every day. What else can really be done? And so we're also like, kind of struggling to get through it. I don't know if that's her intent, but that's certainly something that might go across. But yeah, you might be able to take out like a whole year potentially. I mean, there's just a lot of times that nothing really happens and you get a good sense anyways that the mom's not visiting. So yeah, I agree that you could have potentially cut things down. But also, you know, in terms of romance, which I don't... I wonder if anyone puts a label of romance on here. I suppose you could, but in like a dark sort of way.
Yeah.
That, and you and I have talked about this, I think, you know, it has to be believable in terms of like this attraction that is blooming between them. So that'd be the only thing I would be concerned about is like all of a sudden you go from 12 and 14 to 15 and 17 and then you're like, oh well, what's that in between? Whereas I think she does a good job for the most part to show these things that Kathy is noticing, and she's noticing Chris look at her as well. So I think you potentially have to be careful about that.
Yeah.
I'm cheating, I suppose. I've done this before, but you know, use the resources you have. So in this 40th anniversary edition that I got from the library, there are great questions in the back of the book. So I'll be not using all of them because I do have a couple I think that I want to ask outside of this, but I would, I think there are some great ones. So this one is one of the Enhancer Book Club. I thought it'd be interesting to start off with this. VC Andrews' spine was fused and she was confined to a wheelchair for most of her life. She was left under the care of her mother, with whom she did not have the best relationship. With this in mind, reread the dedication page and discuss how Andrews' personal experience with confinement might have informed the premise of Flowers in the Attic. And if we go back to the dedication, it says, "This book is dedicated to my mother."
Ooh. Is that shade?
Ooh, it does put some things in perspective. Yeah. So what are your thoughts? Is it shade? Is it genuineness? Does her confinement in the wheelchair help with this feeling of claustrophobia as if she were confined in the great room in the attic with the Dahlenganger children?
I want to say, yeah, but I also think that the unseen dynamic between Corinne and Olivia, which is the name of the grandmother, probably comes from her relationship with her own mother, like all Corinne, and or maybe with the grandmother and the kids too. Like if she has this horrible relationship with her mother in real life, clearly she's channeling that into the novel, right? In some way or another. And that kind of speaks to the partially trueness of the story. And yeah, I think that the being confined and this sort of very claustrophobic sort of existence that the kids had, she's probably using some of that energy in there as well.
Yeah, it creates, when you're given that background, which I think is leading in how it's presented, and then you look back at the dedication and you wonder, oh my gosh, was there like some sort of, what is it called? Last bit is Baby Jane.
Whatever happened to Baby Jane?
Yeah, whatever happened to Baby Jane, sort of like that abuse that goes on. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that, yeah, she had a good relationship with her mother, but I can't imagine, obviously now we have multiple different stories going around. Did she know someone at UVA that told her about a story or something like that? Or is this mm-hmm. the thing, which I think don't all great novels have some sort of mythology about it? And like, oh, did you hear that dot, 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 you know, Mary Shelley and Frankenstein and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting to consider. I can see how, especially being, well, actually now that we know that she was confined to a wheelchair, it brings into question the paralyzations that happen in the next 2 to 3 novels. Now
yeah,
I'm like,
I know.
Why did she decide to do that? Yeah, if it is true, because I think we might be like stretching a bit, but I do see it as metaphorical, you know, what is this? Because she has day in, day out, she's in this chair. She can only do certain things potentially. And I think back then, you know, our technology is much more advanced in terms yeah. of wheelchairs and things like that. So potentially, and then, you know, maybe the doppelganger children all are particular pieces or facets of her personality. Like Chris is her optimism and, you know, just getting up each day and being alive. And Kathy might be one of those, maybe that's part of her personality of, you know, well, I am in this chair sort of thing. Yeah. So it's interesting to consider, but it's a lot of sort of guesswork as to the intent of the author.
Mm-hmm.
Religious fanaticism is a motif throughout the novel, and the characters often use religion to punish one another. Discuss some of the religious imagery in the novel and its effects on the characters. Then discuss the horrors in The Flowers in the Attic and compare those to horrors found in the Bible, if you're able to do that. Do you think reading the Bible prepared the children for the inevitability of horror and betrayal? Do you think it made them believe they had to atone for the sins of a previous generation? I want to add something. You can take that question however you want. That's just the okay. question that's in the discussion part. But as I was reading this novel, I kept in my mind flashing to Carrie.
Yes.
And
that's
so
a good
I
point.
Wonder, do you feel like they're sort of spiritually related in that? And then also, what is it about this time period? Because Carrie was also in the 70s, was it not?
Yeah, the film came out in 76 and the novel came out like a couple of years earlier.
Yeah. So what so is it? Is there something about this time period that like religion is yeah, seen in this like really bad light and is used in an abusive way, or is seen as being used in an abusive way?
She's in Virginia. So this is a bit the Bible Belt in some regard, right?
Yep.
And you said she was raised by a Methodist and a Baptist? Or
Southern
just a
Baptist,
Southern Baptist. Okay, so you're talking like hardcore fire and brimstone, possibly. You know, the pastor that married us, was Lutheran, but was originally, he said he was raised Southern Methodist. And he said, you know, there's a straight line you had to walk. And if you stepped off 1 inch this way, you were going to hell. If you stepped off 1 inch the other way, you were going to hell.
Wow.
And that's kind of like what these people are. And also this is that era of the beginning era of like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, Jim Baker and stuff, who would like balloon in the 80s, those televangelists, you know, the ones that people would call in and like send money to, and they would have like televised revivals and like that whole culture, subculture of evangelical Christianity that was done through like, you know, TV Then eventually kind of balloon to like mega churches and that sort of thing. So, and this is also the era of the quote moral majority of the pushback on the sexual revolution through people like Phyllis Schlafly. And I don't know if Anita Bryant was of this era, if she came later, but like that whole conservative woman backlash against feminism. So, and I know a lot of that was tied up with, was tied up in religion, especially what is often referred to as, you know, the evangelical Christianity or baptism and things like that, that were not the very kind of, you know, that had a very, very strict way of doing things. So I saw that in this really, really well. I think it was cartoonish in some ways, but I also have read stories about people being abused religiously in a very similar manner. And, you know, Carrie is, especially the De Palma movie, like Piper Laurie is really good, but she's totally over the top, campy in some places. Olivia is much more sinister. And what we've got here too is the way that they punish their own daughter first, you know, and that's also when you find out at the end, the inheritance was conditioned upon her having no children from her first marriage because they kicked her out for having slept with her uncle or half uncle or whatever. It's also like a very, it's the way that that evangelical Christianity and this very, very hardcore version of Christianity ties itself to the patriarchy, because it's a very like patriarch of the family and the mother as, you know, kind of the helping to enforce the rules of the father, but the father rules everything with the inheritance and everything like that, which is ironic considering the origins that are of Olivia and Malcolm that are shown in the last book of the series, but we'll get to that later. So I think it's just a tool. Now, do I think the reading the Bible prepared the children for the inevitability of horror and betrayal? No, because the children, I think, were naive. They were very young when they went into this, and I think they were naive up until some points. And even then, they were still, I think they saw some things coming and maybe denied it, but I don't think they were like rarely prepared for it. Did they have to atone for the sins of a previous generation? Did that they believe that? I'm kind of like yes or no on this, because it seems like Kathy didn't understand why they had to atone for these things and didn't seem apologetic. So I think the answers to those are kind of like either no or kind of like in a gray area as far as the Bible is concerned, but perhaps you can shed some light on that.
It's interesting, this particular question. And yeah, I'll take it from the biblical standpoint. In regards to Carrie, that was something I was thinking about. Thank you so much for the background there. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, I guess if there's ever a height of religion or something, you know, something is at its height, I think that there's also going to be criticism of it as well, or people will take it sort of in the opposite direction. And that's potentially what's happening there. It's interesting you say that Olivia, which it's funny that I didn't know that her name was Olivia, and I didn't know that the grandfather's name was Malcolm until the synopsis, which I don't think it's ever mentioned.
I don't think it is. No, I don't think it's mentioned in this book, but I want to say they might be named in later books.
I think that might be where it's coming from. So it's sort of like foreshadowing information, because Kathy, I think, doesn't know at this point in time, you know, what their names are. And I appreciate being called the grandmother, that you consider the grandmother here maybe a bit worse than the mother in Carrie. I suppose, yeah, because I guess the mother in Carrie, did she ever physically harm her beyond dragging her?
Physically harm Kathy?
No, in Carrie, did the mother ever physically harm Carrie beyond, like, I feel like she dragged her at one point.
She dragged her. I want to say she, did she hit her? I can't remember.
Yeah.
I know she tried to kill her at the end. But,
yeah, so but, it's hard to say. It's
hard. There was a lot of like locking her in the closet.
Yeah,
though,
yeah.
So and making her prey. So there's a little bit of a parallel there.
There certainly is. Yeah, for sure. It's interesting, just this question. Do you think reading the Bible prepared the children for the inevitability of horror and betrayal? I'm not really sure what what passages?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. What horror stories we see in the Bible?
Listen, if you've not read the Bible, it's really interesting because, you know, people freak out about book bannings and things like that. They're freaking about the new kid and all that stuff. And they're like, we need a Bible in every classroom. And I'm like, the Bible is the most R-rated thing that you could read because of the there's violence, there's sex, there's adultery, there's sexual assault. It's like, it's pretty intense, people.
Yeah.
So I don't know like where this person is thinking, like is getting this stuff, especially if, and it feels like, or it felt like, I now I don't have the pages, that when Kathy and Chris are kind of in this battle of Bible knowledge and spouting off different passages to the grandmother, that a lot of the passages were coming from the Old Testament. And I feel like it would have been completely different had they been reading, you know, the really positive and love-filled New Testament. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure, like, who is betraying who. I mean, just like, are we just getting in very shallowly and like, oh, Cain and Abel, then like, yeah, sure. Or Joseph, you know, and his brother's throwing him in the pit. Sure, that's it. But I don't think like reading this could just be, yeah, they're children. No one's instructing them. This could just be a story for them. So it doesn't really, I think it doesn't click until later. And then, as I said, when they are kind of going back and forth with the grandmother, and the grandmother is like testing them on different things, Chris is using passages that show her hypocrisy, which is why often she'll leave. So I think until it clicks for them what they're reading and what that actually means, I think that they're, and no one can really prepare you for this sort of circumstance. I think no one, if you got locked up in the attic, you'd be like, oh man, I didn't see this coming. My brother betraying me, all of that stuff. Because it was all, the family felt like it was filled with love. Well, the last question about, do you think it made them believe they had to atone? That is a theme, right? The sins of the father will find themselves or whatever.
Be visited upon the son or something. There you go. Like that. Yeah.
And this is something that Kathy continually is battling with. And, you know, she's like, oh man, it really did happen. But also it's a lot of, well, I guess they're just manifesting. We can just go there. That might be easier, because if this weren't, she kept like pushing them into the opposite direction, that if they had just been left alone, I think it would have been fine potentially, which we will talk about nature versus nurture. But it was all, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And Kathy's like, what are you talking about? And Chris, even to a certain extent, though he had maybe more knowledge of sex than Kathy did, because his friends told him stuff apparently. Still, like, if you don't know, how are you going to know? So it's just like, I felt like the grandmother sort of manifested all of this stuff because of her talking and telling them that they were already bad when they didn't do anything.
Yeah, it's ironic, but it's a really good point.
Yeah. On page 36, Kathy says, quote, looking backward to that night ride on the train, I realized that was the very night I began to grow up and philosophize. With everything you gained, you had to lose something. So I might as well get used to it and make the best of it, end quote. Do you agree that this is the moment Kathy began to grow up, or do you think it was at a later point in the book? And if so, at which point and why?
I want to say that this is like where there was a little bit of a spark with her growing up that she comprehended in a way, in a similar way that Chris did, of that things were pretty terrible and that she was going to be thrust into a situation that she's going to have to like protect her younger brother and sister. But I think it was when, I think she grew up a little bit more as time went on in the attic. Probably right around the time the mother stopped coming by as frequently and she started to realize that something was up. And I want to say that's more the moment that it really kicked in. But I want to say this is where it kind of first appeared, but she wouldn't have noticed it. And granted, this also reminds us that the book is being written by Kathy as an adult. Mm-hmm. Looking back, kind of like a To Kill a Mockingbird type of fashion, as an adult, looking back at these events of her life, which also explains a lot of the more adult sounding narration, because some of the narration is, I'm like, this does not sound like somebody who's 12 years old. But then when you're like, you remind yourself, oh wait, this is the older woman looking back on her childhood, it then it fits a little bit better.
Yeah, I would agree. When I was thinking about this question, I thought, oh yes, it's definitely, I think, you know, after the first or third time that the mom's like, it won't be too long now. And Kathy wasn't maybe super close with her mom. I think she definitely was closer to Christopher Sr., mm-hmm. but she's, I don't think, at all disillusioned with her mom. And so once that clicks of like, yeah, we need to make things better. And once they start to change up the attic and like they're making a place livable, I mean, I think that's we're in it. Yeah. And she becomes a mother, so I think there's no turning back after that, unfortunately. Yeah, I think in those moments, especially when she realizes she needs to care for the twins and needs to be that mother replacement for Corinne, she ages up. I'm sure that I've had students that they're forced to be older than they are, mm-hmm. which is very much a tragedy of youth because of just family circumstances, socioeconomic situations. And you see that, and they just have maturity. She's still, it's interesting how she's written, because you see those mature moments, but you're correct in what you said earlier about some of still using mama or kind of her whiny attitude. And she has her up and down, you know, outburst things, like she is still a child. And so you can appreciate that maybe a bit more, but yeah, becoming a mother at 14 is rough. Yeah. Or 12, really.
Yeah. Well, and the word that a lot of my generation knows is parentification. The idea that if you took care of your younger siblings because you were the oldest, or you were left alone as a latchkey kid, so you fended for yourself in some way, you had more responsibility at a very young age than somebody who, than other people, you know. Like I had two working parents, but had a grandmother who lived near me and never felt parentified in the way that some other people I know did, because they would come home and nobody would be home, and they had like a list of things to do, or they had to make themselves dinner sometimes, or in some cases, like one of my friends, she was helping to raise her younger sibling because her dad was working all the time because he was divorced and a single, you know, divorced parent, father, and he had to put kind of a roof over their head and everything. And I had other friends whose parents were either working so much, or one might have had a substance abuse problem. So like, there are a lot of people that, yeah, it's in that sort of that vein of, so when Kathy talked about, like, she like literally talked to Carrie and Corey about being their mom, which I thought was a nice touch in the novel, the way she phrased it to them, because Andrews wrote her talking to them in a way that she thought that the two kids would understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I thought that was one of the things that was well written. Kathy's emotions, especially her tenderness towards the kids and things, I thought that Andrews really, really did that well.
Yes. I don't want to be criticized for my take on love, but I will say that I felt like I will say that perhaps the best love and the only like pure example of love in this novel would in fact be, I think, you know, Kathy and Chris towards the twins, mm-hmm. And just how they're raised.
And the twins toward each other.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, that's one of the most heartbreaking things is, you know, I'm trying to think of what Carrie losing Corey, you know, and just wondering where is my other half, almost like a phantom limb for sure. Yeah.
And credit where credit is due to Andrews, those two are irritating at various points in the novel. I'm like, wait, they're 4, 5, and 6. Of course they're going to be irritating points.
They are, especially just with like the constant complaints, but it's realistic of like, if they don't understand, then they're just going to do it. So asking, or in talking about, you know, maternal figures, I'll ask this question. Corey asked Kathy at one point, are you as good as a real mama? And Kathy responds, yes, I think I am. I love you very much, Corey. And that's what makes a real mother. Do you agree with Kathy's assessment of what a mother is, or do you have another definition for mother? And based on our definitions, how are the grandmother, Corinne, and Kathy mothers?
Oh, wow. I'll take the bottom part of this first. Is the grandmother is more of like a matriarch, I guess is the best way to put it. She's technically a mother because she's biologically the mother to this, you know, Corinne, etc. But she like matriarch in that kind of this ruling over the house and the family aspect of it, and does the things that she does out of a sense of responsibility, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have to bring the kids food every day.
No.
Especially if the plan was to let them die. She has those instincts, and or she does it out of a sense of obligation and responsibility. Corinne, I think, is the one who has the biggest, one of the bigger character, like heel turns in the book, because I think at the beginning of the book, Corinne genuinely loves her kids. And she was never planning on leaving Chris, right? Mm-hmm. Chris gets killed.
Yep.
And then she's like desperate. And that's why she gets back in touch with her parents, because she's like, I have nowhere else to turn. So then she strikes this deal with the devil over the money, but the money consumes her and turns her. So by the end, she really isn't a mother. And we see that happening in quote unquote real time as she thinks. But she, at the beginning, she is, because she does love these children. She's not cold to them from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
But Kathy is, because she cares for the twins. So I think her assessment of what a mother is, very true. You know, the love and the nurturing and the caring, despite the fact that you're not technically the mother, probably supersedes the biology.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we hear it all the time, but sort of this unconditional versus conditional love. And so I think with mother, you know, there's got to be a hierarchy somehow. So obviously, you know, the older and younger works out in that favor. But I think that she loves Kathy, loves her siblings unconditionally, and to be specific, just Carrie and Corey will focus on there, because what she's doing for Chris is something else entirely. Mm-hmm. With Corinne, I would say that she loved them, but the love seems fleeting. And as because I feel like her greatest love is money and being comfortable. And even as the novel continued, I was thinking, did Corinne even truly love Chris Sr.? Because I was questioning that by the end. So I think there are conditions for her love, which is why I don't necessarily consider her, you know, maybe what a mother should be. And then with the grandmother, I would agree that it's just that, yeah, she's sort of this top of the hierarchy, keeping everyone in line as much as she is able to, and being sure that everything is on the up and up, and no one's reputation is falling into disrepair. So I think mother, being a mother, does not have to do with biology or like your relationship, whether that person came out of your body or not. I feel like that does not have to do with it, but in the relationship that you have with them and the love that you have. So fairy tales. So the first day Kathy is locked in the room, she falls in love with the medieval era because of her love for ballet and fairy tales. Did you feel like V.C. Andrews was employing fairy tales across this novel? Were there any that came out in your mind? And also, why go with medieval times? As you know, I was thinking Camelot. Whenever I think Camelot, I also think of the Kennedys. And I wonder, what is it about, you know, Camelot that this sort of happens? But there is like a forbidden love with Camelot too. So that's, you know, a good connection for Kathy and Chris. But your thoughts on maybe this theme that also pops up?
The fairy tale thing, actually, the funny thing is that the entire time I read this book, when I saw the grandmother scenes and stuff, I kept picturing the evil stepmom from Cinderella, from the Disney cartoon, the classic Disney cartoon. You know the look, right?
I do.
That's who I pictured as Olivia. And it really worked for me because she's clearly the evil stepmother character, the stepmonster. There is a Rapunzel aspect to Kathy. In fact, to the point where at one point they do try to sneak out of the house and they test like essentially a rope made of sheets, like in an old prison movie. And they get down, but they have a hard time getting back up because they do sneak out for one night. So there's that. There is a little bit of Cinderella in Kathy as well. She never does get to go to the ball, you know, and maybe Corinne too. Corinne does get to go to the ball and she finds her Prince Charming. So I think she's definitely pulling from those. The kids, maybe a little Hansel and Gretel and Corinne and Corey because of the donuts and the witch giving them the food that might kill them. And so, yeah, I see her pulling from those as influences.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. Which one was the one I was thinking of? Oh, Rapunzel was the one, yeah, that I immediately thought of. And it is interesting how there's this juxtaposition potentially between princess and witch. That was something that was brought up in the intro, which your intro is same as my intro, was by, or foreword was by Gillian Flynn.
Yeah.
And she talks about that. And that was something that was interesting for me because I thought, wow, it's always these like diametrically opposed things, these ideas. And then I thought, man, well, that goes all the way back to, you know, the epics when you have either the doting housewife or you've got the sorceress, you know, it's sort of like the same thing. And you wonder, are there no other, like, where's the spectrum of idea of women and characters and things like that. So I also felt like if mythology and myths are also fairy tales, I kind of thought about that too. Just people being locked up. I mean, Circe, you know, turned.
Well, there's also and there's that, epic poetry thing of either when you have the doting housewife and the sorceress, they're both tricky in some way. Cause don't forget that Penelope tricks the suitors for the better part of 3 years with the funeral shroud and the three, Carrie aside, cause Carrie's a child, a little child, Kathy, Corinne and Olivia are all tricksters in some way or another at some point or another.
Yeah.
Kathy more so, and from what I've read from the synopsis of the sequel novels, but yeah.
In order to survive, you gotta be tricksy.
Yep.
Grandmother Olivia was apparently reluctant to allow Corinne to come with the kids, yet she relented. What do you think her motive was? Did she feel forced to do it?
I don't know. I wonder, did the grandfather know and see that and basically give her the condition of letting her back in? We don't know what Kathy wrote in her letter. So was the last letter that Corinne supposedly wrote agreeing to conditions or something like that? Like, you know, was it a control thing for the grandmother? I'm not sure what her motivation was for allowing Corinne and the children into the house, aside from the fact that the plot demanded it.
Yeah, this was, I think, for me, maybe the greatest... I was going to say weakness. It's just a question that is not answered. And it's just so confusing because of what the grandmother does. I'm just thinking, why even let them in if this is going to be the whole situation? And then, you know, the grandfather dies and it persists. And so it's just a big old question mark. I don't know if this is answered in the end, you know, the remaining three novels.
I don't know.
This is her motivation. I have no idea. Unless it was her trying to maybe return to a quote unquote mother. I don't know. Was anything to do with reputation?
Yeah.
Because, you know, people knew a bit about not everything, but, you know, Corinne left. So I think there were certainly questions. I am unsure.
There is, you know, yeah. And I mean, the cynical part of me is like, it's also about control. So she controlled the daughter. But I think your point about reputation is she can re-debut her at the Christmas party. Like she essentially does. She debuts again into society. So there's something that bolsters Olivia's reputation. So maybe she saw how she can manipulate the situation in favor of herself. And you get the feeling that this abusive sort of behavior toward the kids is something she had already done in the past anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Or she was always like that. So that was not that hard to do. Like, yeah. That's how she raised her kids, or that's what she knew about raising kids.
Yeah, that's true. You only know what you're taught and what you experience.
So not the locking them in the attic. I mean, the cold distant aspect of it, controlling aspect.
Which is, you know, if we were to go back to the previous, an earlier question, it's great that, as far as I know, what it seems like in this novel anyways, that Kathy breaks that cycle as a mother. But who knows what happens in the next three? Well, I guess you do. On page 254, Kathy says, "Chris, remember when Mama told us that it was money that made the world go round and not love? Well, I think she's wrong. Do you agree with Kathy or Corinne?" So Corinne, she thinks money makes the world go round, or you agree with Kathy and it's love? And if you're able to, you can pull some examples.
I mean, it's in the novel, money changes people. Money, you know, there is a sort of a truth to it. Like, it's a very cynical way to put it, but there is some sort of a truth to it. The idea, though, the happy ending is that love wins in the end, but even then, it's kind of it's not a complete ending or happy ending. It's like a, what is the phrase? Pyrrhic victory?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that, like, you know, they've lost a lot, but they finally got out of it. You know, but I think their love is where they can center themselves. But money is a huge influence on people, and we see that because of Corinne. Yeah, because it's to the point where, like, later on, she's love bombing them with gifts.
Yeah.
And to the point where she, like, does not realize how old the kids are anymore. Because she buys Kathy or Chris some clothes that don't fit, because she's like, I'm not, or she won't buy her a bra.
Yep.
Right? I think she has the period talk with her, but that's about it as far as her daughter growing up. So it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, depending on what character you're looking at. But I totally see why Kathy said that.
Yeah, with love, I mean, it feels like it might be a naive worldview, but I also think maybe it's super wise, because I think even with all the money in the world, people can be super lonely, you know, and they need that love. I think of King Midas, you know, after he touched his daughter accidentally and she turned to gold, like, that was the worst thing. And then he's like, please remove this curse from me. Yeah, I mean, in a practical way, you know, you have to have money in order to survive. But I think love can push you to survival. Like, you'll make it somehow. You'll come up with some sort of way in order to make it. But even as we saw, right, they had their escape plan, but they needed money for it. So, you know, they kept stealing in order to afford it. So. Yeah, I would agree. A little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. The Dahlengangers are an extremely touchy-feely family. Their father would come home expecting to be hugged and kissed by the whole family. Corinne and her husband would kiss their children full on the lips, and Corinne cuddled Chris in a way Kathy described as letting him, quote, drown in the sensuality of being cuddled close to that creamy flesh that must excite even a youth of his tender years. On page.
Wow.
I know. Seriously, look at that. What a wordsmith. This physical closeness obviously leads Chris and Kathy to do things normal children their age would never think of doing with a sibling, talking to each other while bathing, sitting on a brother's lap, resting a head on the other's chest while having their hair stroked. I feel like some of those are more innocent than maybe we're making, but I could be. I don't know. Someone just.
No, I agree with you.
Hair stroke. I feel like there's not something inherently bad with that. But anyways, are these physical displays of emotion learned from their parents, or are incestuous urges something that can be inherited? Do you blame Corinne for Chris and Kathy starting an incestuous relationship?
I only blame Corinne in that she locked them in the attic. I don't think this is, you know, the affection shown by the parents when they're young. I didn't find that any weirder than anybody else. Right. Mm-hmm. I just felt it was a loving family, and they are touchy feely, but it's okay to be touchy feely as a family. You know, I think where they start having the physical closeness, before, you know, when, especially when they're younger, I don't think it came from the way, I don't know, Kathy let Chris drown in her boobs or whatever the thing was, or Corinne did. I want to say it's that Kathy and Chris at first were emulating parents, right? So the idea that like they were the mother and father to the twins, so they were but their only contacts for a mother and father were their own mother and father, who were very touchy-feely and lovey. So they kind of established a close relationship like that, and it eventually grew into what it did. A lot of it is circumstantial, and that's where Corinne and Olivia do get the blame for what happened. But it's not like because it wasn't, I don't think, anything that was inherited, and I don't think that it happened because of what the parents did to them when Chris was still alive.
I mean, I think certain fam I've seen all sorts of touchy-feely stuff as a teacher, so I think it ranges. I've not seen anything. I'm sure there is inappropriate stuff, but I've not seen anything that's inappropriate. So yeah, just some people I think are more showing love via physical affection than others. Yes, I think this kind of stuff, or sin, if we were to go on the biblical route, there is not it's not inherited via DNA. It's not like dignitas, which is a Roman virtue that was passed down from father to son. It's a positive Roman virtue. So I dismiss that. And then it's kind of, was this inevitable almost? Was being locked up together with other people? Again, I don't think so. I think, I think it's forced to happen plot wise. Kind of have to, suspend your disbelief a little bit. Hormonally, it probably would be very hard to be like locked up and have one room and one bathroom. It's, with, growing boys and growing girls. And again, I still, this whole thing of like basically it was manifested because the if you didn't put the seed in there, like the seed of whatever it was, then I think it might not have grown in this fashion.
That's a
But
good point.
yeah, or having more of a discussion about, don't do this, and this is why you shouldn't do this. So to continue with their relationship, the bad part, Chris does in fact rape Kathy. Rape, I think, is used actually, the word itself. So just to be clear, it wasn't like, oh, I'm reading between the lines and this is it. Kathy tells Chris not to feel guilty for raping her because she was tempting him by walking around in skimpy clothes. Later, while in bed, she wonders if they were destined to repeat the sins of their parents. So we're coming back to that sort of question as well. Well, I have a couple of things, I guess, with this. Why do you think Kathy took on Chris's guilt as her own? Do you think this was necessary in the novel? Yeah, the victim blaming that is happening, is that because of the some of the gender stereotypes? Like clearly it would be, this is not Stella speaking, this is like society. Clearly it would be the woman's fault that this happened.
The what was she wearing question.
Yes, yeah.
I think it is playing into those stereotypes, and I don't want to say Andrews was trying to enforce them. I think that she had established the grandmother as like the type who would blame her. Like she kept telling the kids that them being in the same room was going to bring about sin, right? Like we were saying. So the grandmother basically put the idea in Kathy's head that she would be to blame for something like this happening. I don't like this. I don't like I don't like rape scenes. Who does? Well, I'm sure somebody does, but I don't know how necessary it was because it doesn't really get brought up again. Like it could have been a sex scene that started with him being jealous, but in a more tender way. And then it was just essentially like a lovemaking scene, which ew. But still, kind of took me out of the book where I was just like, why is he raping her? You know? And then for her to say, well, it was my fault, that tracked with logically within the book. Mm-hmm. Like, I can totally see how she felt that. And I think she took it on her own because that's how she was taught. And she also was she was desperately in love with her brother. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in a captive situation like that, she doesn't want to, you know, she's already being abused. So she doesn't exactly have, like, she's got this, the mindset to be like, to carry a lot of that guilt and everything. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because which was another question about gender stereotypes, that it seems like DC Andrews does lean into them, mm-hmm. but then there are other times that she might want to try to break away. Like page 324, Chris tells Kathy, "That was Mama's trouble. She thought she'd always have a man to lean on. Lean on yourself, Kathy, always."
Yeah.
But one or two, you know, moments is not enough to sort of break, I think, the mind control that is already laid there. And then you were talking about, I guess, really what the second wave? Is that the second wave of feminism?
I think so. You know,
Babs came, well, Babs was 67 and that was second wave. So I just wonder if it was third wave.
I don't remember when, I don't know how they delineate. I don't know if the third wave was later or not.
Yeah, I guess I can look up to see which wave that was. But yes, so I don't know if Andrews is just too in too deep and cannot necessarily break too far outside of that. But if mm-hmm. this is supposed to be a romance, sorry, I almost choked on the word because it's hard for me to get around. I feel like, why did we have to go this route? Especially because the violence that was happening was all external violence from I would consider what the mother does, the mother and the grandmother onto the children. It was never internal of the children against each other. Sure, they had fights, but never like physical altercations. Mm-hmm. And so I think that breaks something that was beautiful about, you know, those four children as a unit. And if we were pushing, obviously we're pushing this romance between these two, and I feel like you could have just stuck with, you could have only done kissing and that would have sufficed. I think, you know, we're still 17 and 15, so if you really had to do it, you could have waited until the next novel when you were adults and in college or however old they are. So yeah, it's interesting. It is unfortunate. Yeah, I think it's just a lot of brainwashing that everything comes back to Kathy. It was her fault when she was half naked mm-hmm. in front of the mirror, even though, you know, Chris was standing there and, you know, her hair was to blame, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, unfortunately, the woman often gets the blame. But I mean, if mm-hmm. it's interesting because if you go back biblically, right, Eve is the one who gets the blame for everything, even yeah. though the man, I feel like, you know, Adam.
He's the one who made the decision to actually eat the apple.
I know, he has free will. I mean, he could have said no. So I guess this is almost like a biblical thing too, of like, well, yeah, Eve and her sin carrying down too, and yeah, leading quote unquote well, leading the man to stray.
Yeah. And in certain religious mythology, isn't Lilith the one who rejected the idea of being subservient to the man? Although Lilith isn't really mentioned in the Bible itself, but isn't that kind of like, I'm just talking out of my head here. Woman.
Well, that's because you're what, you using Rachel Rising?
I'm thinking Rachel Rising. Yeah. But wasn't Lilith kind of like the independent, like didn't need Adam type of thing? And I'm simplifying and I apologize.
Yeah.
I'm probably misinterpreting it too. So by the way, second wave feminism.
She refused submission. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Second wave feminism, generally 1960s to the 1980s, and third wave feminism, early 90s into the 2000s.
Gotcha. Okay. There you go. So still in the second.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'm winding down, but keeping with the sex topic, there was something that's not in here, but I was curious about, and I wonder what you have to think. There is a point, attention brought to a picture book that may or may not be the Kama Sutra within Corinne's bedroom. Do you remember this?
Yes. It's like a, I thought it might just have been like a pornography.
It might, yeah. I think it definitely was showing like sexual positions and things like that. I just wondered what you thought the purpose of that was. I know it sort of pushes maybe the sexual awakening or at least questioning. Mm-hmm. There's a comment which I found interesting. I think Kathy makes it about, oh, is this how women keep younger men interested because Bart is younger than Corinne? Mm-hmm. Or yeah, just what is the purpose of that particular, I don't know, stage dressing, as it were? Do you have any thoughts? Did that strike you as odd?
Do you remember where it was?
Oh, it was when they first snuck out. So that's
okay, 320 and 321. So she found a book underneath those paperbacks. So she said, like, all these paperback books, right? Underneath those paperbacks was a very large and thick book with a colorful dust jacket, How to Create Your Own Needlework Designs.
Ooh.
Now, that was the title really intrigue me. Mama had taught me to do some needlepoint stitches and also crewel work on my first birthday in that locked room. And How to Create Your Own Design would be indeed be inspiring. Casually, I lifted the book out the book and flipped through the pages at random. Behind me, Chris was making soft noises. He opened and closed drawers and moved down the sneakered feet here and there, blah, blah, blah. I expected to see flower designs, anything but what I actually saw. Silent, wide-eyed, full of stunned fascination, I stared down at the photographs in full color. Unbelievable pictures of naked men and women doing... Did people really do such things as that? Was this lovemaking? Chris wasn't the only one who'd heard whispered tales accompanied by much snickering from school children, etc. This book depicted many pictures, couples in all in one room and naked and all into each other in one way or another. Against my will, or so I wanted to think, my hands stole out to slowly turn each page, growing ever more incredulous. So many ways to do it, so many positions. My God, was this what lovesick Raymond and Lily had in mind from page one of that Victorian novel? I lifted my head and stared blankly into space. From the beginning of life, we were all headed toward this, and that's when Chris, like, kind of gets her out of the room. So it kind of is like the Kama Sutra or something like that. It has mm-hmm. to be, because it's not a porno mag. Yeah, that's an interesting scene, especially since, like, so what's funny is that, like, the discovery that your parents are adults and have sex, right? That's, even if you never walk in on them, which hopefully you never do, the idea that that's what happens and they have a life that involves that and might involve preferences, kinks, those sorts of things is jarring to a kid, because you never picture your parents like that and never want to, even as an adult. So that's part of it. Corinne, really immature that she has to sneak the thing like a child, because she obviously put mm-hmm. the dust jacket of the needlebook cover over the needlebook book over the actual book, so that it looks like when if grandma opens the drawer, she sees the needlepoint book and is like, doesn't even wonder what it is, you know. So she's still sneaking around like a teenager or a child or something. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because it's not, because this is the very late 50s, early 1960s, so this is just as the sexual revolution kind of starts, but even then it's before that. So yeah, that's an interesting thing, because Kathy's, like, mind is blown and she doesn't exactly really comprehend what's going on. It kind of freaks her out a little bit too, right? So I get it. I get why Corinne would have it. I don't know what the impact is on beyond, like, being freaked out at that one moment. But then again, she's so innocent in this whole thing with Chris at the same time. You know, it's a mess. It's the best way I could put it. What do you think? Did I make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think it's, yeah, potentially titillation gets you asking questions potentially, because I think it does lead to a conversation, if I recall correctly, because I think she tells Chris about it, and maybe Chris on one of his later visits looks at it and then he talks about, oh, learned about that stuff from my friends in the locker room.
Yeah.
I think there's like a connection there. And yeah, I think sex and sexuality is threaded throughout this novel. So I think that's just another way potentially to show it. But I think there's mm-hmm. also maybe an interesting gender commentary of, you know, what do women have, older women, what do older women need in order to keep a man? And, oh, well, it might be sex. It might be interesting sexual positions, etc. So again, leaning into that, I think. Well, yeah, you said sexual revolution, but I do feel like that kind of goes backwards too, doesn't it?
It's interesting that this is like pre-sexual revolution, the when it's taking place.
Yeah.
Or like kind of right at the beginning of it. What's interesting to me is that it's presented in the context of pleasing a man, aside from figuring out what pleases you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's one thing to be a woman, and I don't have an experience in being a woman, but it's one thing to be a woman and discovering and discovering your own sexuality and what your preferences are and what gets you off, and do you have any certain desires or kinks or fantasies or fetishes or something. It's another thing to be looking at this because because you feel that you need to do it in order to please.
Yeah.
The man. Because you could be looking into these to please your partner in a way that's reciprocal, right? Yeah. Like, mm-hmm, it is a true partnership, and I'm looking into this because maybe he'll like it, or maybe she'll like it, or maybe they'll like it. But this is more like, if I do this, I can get him. Like, this is way more subservient than it is liberating in the way this is, the context in which this is being presented. Or maybe secretly Corinne does want to explore those things, but we don't get enough of her at this point to really know that.
Yeah. And I think it maybe begs the question is, what value does Corinne specifically, and women in general, what value do they have? And mm-hmm. What is this novel saying? Like, what is the answer that the novel is giving?
Yeah.
And because she doesn't, I can't tell if she's lying about this job, that because she's supposed to be training to be a stenographer,
yeah,
or a typist. And so I don't know. She doesn't have money. Is it just her looks? We're told that she is beautiful. And so is that really it? Which we've been told, like, this is very toxic, because that's just passing down what women are often told of, like, well, you're good for one thing. And so this is like pushing that home, I think, if this is true, like, well, this is the way I need to get Bart and keep Bart.
She was a sheltered society girl to begin with anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we even saw, well, when Kathy and Chris they snuck out that one night, Bart was groping Corinne.
At the Christmas party, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was before they were like together.
Yeah.
And he seemed to be asking her to like have sex too. So yeah, I don't know. I think my last one, that's okay with you.
Okay.
Okay. Flowers in the Attic plays into the fear of turning into one's mother for the worse. At the beginning of the novel, the children believe that their grandmother is truly evil, and they cannot understand why Corinne would bring them to this great house after she had lived with her own mother and knew what would happen to them. But as the story unfolds, they slowly see that Corinne is just like their grandmother, maybe even worse. Who do you think was a worse mother to the children, and who do you think was worse to the Dahlenganger children? And as a secondary question, without what you might know, but just from this novel, whom do you think was poisoning the children?
When I got to the end of the novel and read the section where Chris reveals all that stuff, I was like, oh crap, the mom was doing it the whole time. The grandmother was certainly complicit. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I did believe that it was Corinne's idea, because I think she started to, I want to say through her head, as she re-entered this society of whatever it was, and she met Bart and she had this independence, she stopped seeing the kids, because I think she started to see the kids as an obstacle or a burden, especially when it was tied to her father's money. And so many of her actions in the book were done out of desperation, and this is like a cruel desperation, and then just generally cruel. She poisoned her children.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the grandmother did that, because she would have done it earlier. And I want to say that she started doing it, like, I think it's a clue of when she starts bringing the donuts is probably coincides with around the time the grandfather is dead, or when Corinne found out about what the circumstances of the money were, right? So I don't know if the grandmother, do you think the grandmother knew?
Oh, what was
that? The donuts were poisoned?
Well, who was, how did the servant, so the only connect is the servants knowing that there was rat poison being placed. So where was that coming from? Was the grandmother saying that she needed to be dosing the attic somehow with all of this stuff because of the mice, the invisible mice that didn't exist?
Yeah.
Or was Kathy, wait, or was Corinne telling them that, oh yeah, dot, dot, dot? Or was that just to reveal that, oh yeah, there's a lot of arsenic around?
Yeah. There's probably the arsenic around, I'm looking.
And I do wonder, because at a certain point, Corinne, well, I guess she was still living there for a time. So she would have had, she just wasn't visiting the kids. Because otherwise, yeah, it's the grandmother is really the one who's doing all of the, so I guess maybe Corinne came into the kitchen, dosed the donuts, and then the grandmother moved them up there. I mean, mm-hmm. I agree with you that I think that it was Corinne, which was very shocking. Because yeah, the grandmother, beyond, she did lash, right? Did she use a lash to
Chris? Switch.
Yeah. Yeah, I think murder's not on her list. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Why wouldn't she have done it sooner? They were up there for 3 years.
I thought he overheard the servants talking about it, but I don't know exactly where.
Oh, yeah. Well, because then they have the sexy time.
Yeah.
That was near the end, I think. That was very, very near the end. I feel like that was a catalyst of like, well, better get out now. GTFO, yeah, if you will.
Chris even says at one point that he doesn't think, like, he overheard grandmother praying and does not think that she did it.
Yeah, because if she's all Old Testament,
yeah,
thou shalt not murder.
She said it's Mama, Chris, this is 386. Chris said in a low voice, recall when she said she'd do anything to win back her father's approval so she could inherit? I don't know what made her promise, but I did overhear the servants talking. Kathy, a few days before our grandfather died, he had a codicil added to his will. It states that if our mother was ever proven to have given birth to children by her first husband, she will have to forfeit everything she inherits and return everything she's bought with the money, including clothes, jewels, investments, everything. And that's not all. He had even had it written in that if she has children by her second marriage, she will lose everything too. Mama thought he had forgiven her. He didn't forgive or forget. He would keep on punishing her from his grave. So then Kathy says, Mama, it was Mama and not the grandmother. And he shrugged as if indifferent, which I knew he couldn't be. I heard that old woman praying by her bed. She's evil, but I doubt she would put poison in the donuts herself. She would carry them up to us and know we ate the sweets, when all along she warned us not to eat them. But Chris, it couldn't have been Mama. She was on her honeymoon when the donuts started becoming daily. Yeah, but 9 months ago, the will was read. 9 months ago, Mama was back. Only Mama benefits from the grandfather's will, not our grandmother. She has her own money. She only brought up the baskets. She only brought up the baskets each day. So he's implying that he pieced it together, and that he did hear from the servants, and that the only one with the timing and everything, the only one who could have done it was the mother, and the grandmother either knew and just let it happen, it was complicit, or the mother somehow kept her in the dark about it.
Yeah.
Which it could be either. I don't know, you know, how much. Which, yeah, and that's when I started kind of putting two and two together, and I was just like, and the whole time, you know, you saw the mother drifting away, and I was like, there's something about this woman that's just not, the mother never sat right.
Yeah.
Once they got to the house.
Don't even call her a mother.
I know.
I just thought of something. There was another question talking about the connection that the two eldest have with the opposite sex parents. And I did wonder, do you feel like Andrews is taking inspiration from maybe Oedipus and Electra as well here? Or is this a typical thing where, you know, yeah, you've got daddy's little girl.
Daddy's girl and mama's boy.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of both, especially since it does kind of feed into the what happens with the two of them, and the fact that they were a product of incest between an uncle and a niece. So
yeah,
Yeah, I think it works both ways.
Yep. Okay, Tom. Final question. I'm sure it'll be easy. is it required reading?
No. But if you're curious.
Yeah, give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go. Give it at least one of these
a beach because, read like, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, it's not great, but it is entertaining once you get into it. And if you're like, I wonder what the big deal was about this book, yeah, pick it up and read it. But I'm going to say no, this is not required reading.
Okay, now so. You're going to tell us about the rest of the Doll
Yeah, so there, saga. There are five books total in the Doll Jaeger saga. If you don't count like the ones that were written years after, from like the point of view of Christopher, which I'm not considering here. I'm just considering the ones that came out while Andrews was alive, as well as the last one, which is published posthumously. So book two is called Petals on the Wind. It's the direct sequel. Like, it literally picks up where the first novel left off. And this is the longest bit of summary on a novel I'm going to give, because I went through the Wikipedia pages and I just tried to kind of like really condense it down to kind of like high points, because they get crazier and crazier in terms of the plot twists and the turns. But so the kids board a bus at Charlottesville, but they try to get all the way to Florida, but Carrie gets sick on the way. They end up in South Carolina, and like a mute black woman named like Henny or something takes them in. And Henny and her employer is Dr. Paul Sheffield. And like, he's like important to the rest of the story. So things that happens, first of all, that Christmas, Kathy bleeds a lot from her, you know, from her uterus. Oh. And she has to have a DNC, and they think it was just like irregular periods based on the what they endured, but she's pretty sure she miscarried Chris's baby.
Oh my gosh.
Chris will eventually grow up to go to medical school. Kathy grows up and eventually joins a ballet school in New York. Carrie mourns Corey the whole time, and her growth has basically been stunted by what had happened in the attic. Chris does express feelings for Kathy, but Kathy rejects them and starts plotting and kind of like says, no, I need to have kind of like a normal relationship when we can't be together like that. And then she starts planning revenge on her mother. Kathy's revenge on her mother basically drives like the whole novel. Most of the novel does Kathy narrates this novel. And so it centers around her life and her romances. She has two children, Jory with her first abusive husband named Julian, and then Bart Jr. Bart Jr.'s father is her mother's second husband, Bart. Kathy had set out to seduce him as revenge for what her mother did, but she ended up falling in love with him. She also married Paul at one point, but Paul had died. So then Carrie meets a man named Alex, but he tells, and they fall in love, but he tells he wants to go be a minister. She freaks out because she's got like this trauma based on all the religious stuff. Oh, and she eats arsenic laced powdered donuts.
Oh my gosh.
And ends up in the hospital. She reveals to Kathy that the real reason behind her suicide attempt was that she spotted their mother on the street one day, approached her, and Corinne angrily rejected her. And then Carrie dies. So I'm giving kind of slightly truncated read of the climax of the novel as summarized by Wikipedia. It's about three paragraphs and it's just really crazy. So I just wanted to read it. So
I do feel like, I just want to say that I find that unbelievable, because Carrie, like, I feel like the twins forgot what their mother looked like. Mm-hmm. So for Carrie to recognize her mother on the street seems like a stretch. But
there's a lot of suspension disbelief and then and continuity stuff. But so the plan is for Kathy to confront her mother, and she decides to do it on the eve of the annual Christmas ball. So she shows up to Foxworth Hall wearing a replica of the gown that Corinne wore to that Christmas party, the one that they snuck out and saw her with Bart, you know, from earlier in the movie, in the book. Okay, so she visits the room where she and her siblings were locked away. She sees that it has been untouched since they escaped. At the stroke of, and this is years and years later, at least a decade or so. At the stroke of midnight, she appears in the ballroom and exposes the truth to Bart and the party guests. Bart takes Kathy and Corinne to the library where the grandmother is seated. At first, Bart believes Kathy is lying, but after hearing Kathy's whole story, he confronts Corinne. Corinne breaks down, claiming to be the real victim because her father had known his grandchildren were hidden in his home and he wanted them to die in captivity. She claims that she gave the children arsenic to make them sick gradually so she could sneak them out to safety one by one and then tell her parents the children had died in the hospital. Corinne says she stashed Corey's body in a ravine, but Kathy accuses her of hiding Corey in a small room off the attic that gave off a telltale odor, which doesn't make a lot of sense because when the heck was Kathy in the attic? Anyway, again, you got to throw continuity out the window for some of these things because it's just, again, just go with the crazy. Chris bursts into the library at that point. Corinne perceives him as the ghost of his father, her first husband. She suffers a mental breakdown and then she sets fire to Foxworth Hall. Corinne, Chris, and Kathy escape, but Bart and the grandmother are trapped and die in the fire. Corinne is then committed to a mental institution. Don't worry, she gets out. At the very end of the novel, Kathy realizes that Chris was the right one for her all along and that she still loves him. They move to California with the two boys and live as the Sheffields. Kathy dreads what will happen if their secret is exposed, and the book ends with her stating that she has been having strange thoughts about the attic in their house and has put two twin beds up there. Although I don't know if anything comes of that, but that's the end of Petals in the Wind. Book three is called If There Be Thorns. Ooh. So this is all about how Bart Jr., the second kid of Kathy, is a complete psycho. Corinne, and I believe it's narrated by both Bart Jr. and Jordy. Corinne, the mother, ends up moving in next door to Chris and Kathy, although they don't know it's her. Mm-hmm. She influences Bart Jr. There's this whole thing with him and Jordy, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, except to tell you that Kathy and Corinne end up, once again, in a fire. And this time, Corinne saves Kathy and dies in the fire. I think she sets fire to like her basement or something. And then Corinne forgives Kathy after that is over.
Bart does some nuts things.
Oh, gosh.
Well, because he finds out about his parentage.
He finds out his parents, the whole thing. And he just like, you know, and like Kathy is way more attentive to Jory because Jory's like a dancer as well. So he's more sweet and Bart, you know, so there's a whole, you know, sibling rivalry going on to the point where like Bart sleeps with Jory's wife. Because at one point, either in the third or fourth book, Jory becomes paraplegic.
People become paralyzed in this novel.
And then, like, the wife moves off. It's crazy. The wife's name's like Cindy. It's crazy. So book four is Seeds of Yesterday. So Bart Jr. rebuilds South Foxworth, essentially. He builds a house that's just like it. Corinne's thought-to-be-dead brother, Joel, shows up. Joel, who had supposedly died in an avalanche. Again, this is very soap opera. So what he does, he turns Psycho Bart into an evangelical Christian. It's a huge convoluted soap opera. It covers the rest of Kathy's life. It features Bart eventually becoming a televangelist. After Chris dies in a hit and run accident, just like their dad, Kathy goes up to the attic of the new Foxworth, decorates it with paper flowers, and dies of a broken heart. And then finally, there's book five. Now, this is the one was published posthumously and either written completely or be finished by the ghostwriter. It's called Garden of Shadows. And this is a prequel. This is about Olivia, the grandmother, how she came to Foxworth. And I can't really give it justice except to say it tells you how like Corinne got kicked out of the house and who Corinne's actual parents are, because like, I don't think Malcolm's her actual father. And it's, you know, there's a lot of parallels between who Corinne is and who Olivia was before she, you know, came to Foxworth. The Wikipedia summary is great because it's a twisty, turny, crazy novel. And then there's a whole section on the page that lists all the continuity errors between that novel and the rest of the series.
So some nerd wrote that.
Yeah. So it is, again, it's very, like I said, this was the height of the soap opera era, the Days of Our Lives and General Hospital and all of these things. So it's back guano crazy. So if you're interested in reading them, you could probably find them at your library or used bookstore.
Lovely. Well, thanks for all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully people don't have nightmares.
All right. So before we get to the next book, we do have one piece of feedback. It is on our episode about lessons in chemistry. There were like three comments from Robert Ward that I strung together. The first one, he says, you don't have to say this on the pod, sorry, but this one was a do not finish for me dog. I powered through about halfway. I couldn't take it with this book. And then he said, I don't want to comment throughout the episode. I'm gonna skip to his third comment. He does talk about The Count of Monte Cristo. It was kind of like a tangent there. And he says it's more than 50 hours long. It's 20 more than Vanity Fair. He's doing a year-long read-through that's only two or three chapters a week. He's really enjoying it. Want to read it quicker. The subreddit about it is great. There's a weekly discussion post, and someone has been posting notes on the chapters in the original French versus translations by Gutenberg, Google, and Robin Buss, the Penguin Classic. So, again, that's one of those books I keep hearing about, and everybody I talk to says it's amazing, and I just will, maybe one day I will read it. But back into the stuff about lessons in chemistry. So this was his second post comment. He says, I don't want to comment throughout the episode, but immediately I'm struck with how awful the taste Stella has in love. I was sorely tempted to throw my phone / AirPods out the window, let alone across the room with this thing. When the fraudulently enrolled kindergartner asks for Norman Mailer via her school, I literally let out a string of expletives that is probably still hanging in space over Lake Michigan. Nice Christmas story reference. There is nothing charming about the book's absurdity. I disagree with the book's absurdity thing. I found the thing charming, but we already talked about that. But did you want to address the comment yourself?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, you wrote a comment, so I will comment on the comment. Intent versus impact. Tom and I were talking about, like, maybe the intent of what you said, that I have apparently awful taste in love, that maybe it was supposed to be tongue in cheek, though I certainly didn't take it that way. Tom also didn't take it that way. I'm speaking for him because he told me that. And I also, someone who's not involved in this podcast whatsoever and has never listened to it, I read that first comment and he said, whoa, after it. So I was struck with that comment.
Mm-hmm. You texted me about it.
Yeah, I was pretty upset about it for a while. And I feel like comment all you want on the book, but I think potentially not on that sort of thing. So I have several things to say. So if you are having a bad day, which we don't know, you know, I can, everyone has a bad day. This kind of stuff though is now living on there forever in the internet. I don't think anyone can judge someone else's idea of what love is unless it's abusive and toxic, in which case we have to actually reach out to them in love and mm-hmm. sort of pull them away from that. Mm-hmm. I scratched my brain for several days afterwards thinking, did I say anything unhinged? And I'm like, no, I did in my February episode with Tom, but I didn't even say anything. And then I was just like thinking about all the relationships in there. And still I'm saying, like, yeah, I don't know what you aren't seeing.
Yeah.
I think there is some underlying sexism here that I'm going to call out, because I don't think he would have said this to Tom. Mm. And Tom, I'm speaking for him, feel like he agreed with me nearly 100% of the discussion mm-hmm. about the relationships and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you here. I'd have to go back and listen to the episode, like, to get really into specific about what was being said, but I don't remember not agreeing with you on really anything about the book.
Yeah,
and I do agree. It was, if it was meant to be kind of sarcastic and witty, I don't think it landed the way.
Yeah,
and I think that, like, you know, because it does come off as kind of insulting, because it's just, that's an odd. It's also an odd thing to say. And, you know, we were talking about it too in the context of a book, and I realized it's not, like, you know, a book that you necessarily like, but it did seem a little too personal of a comment. So,
yeah. And I would also say something that actually frustrates me about this show is that, and I asked Tom about this, where I was like, I feel like I get more criticism than Tom does. And again, I'm speaking for him, but I think he said probably. So he didn't like affirm 100%.
No,
But
I noticed that too.
I do get stuff. And unfortunately, like I can remember something I got from the Gillian Flynn novel. Mm-hmm. The other issue is like, if you make this sort of claim, you know, I have terrible taste in love, you've got to back it up with some sort of evidence. Cause right. otherwise I'm stuck again, scratching my head as to like, well, where's that coming from? So when people like criticize me on something, I have no idea. Cause after I record an episode or I've edited it, like I'm not thinking about it anymore. Mm-hmm. So you can't just drop that and then just leave. Cause there's like, it's just basically, this is America where you drop a claim and there's no evidence. We need to fight against that. So if you could please next time, or just like, maybe, I don't know, don't criticize me. I feel like I'm trying to do the best I can as a podcast yeah. host. I don't know where that's going. And again, my knee jerk is like, yeah, that's just, unfortunately, it's sexism. Like, you're going to go after the woman, then you are the man. And that's honestly how I'm perceiving it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. To lighten things, to take us out of this up, when it does come to a matter of you and taste, based on the romance book covers you send me, although you're trolling me,
yeah, so I
I don't think that you really are looking for love with some sort of not weird mythical creature.
No, I am like, at my heart, like very much a shipper and a romantic, and I think like traditional, you know, romances and whatever that might look like. But no, like anything unhinged, I feel like I'm pretty straight and narrow, as it were. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Cool. Lovely. Well, Tom, and I mean, so Robert, I just, you know, laid you out there, but it's always good to, you know, gotta hold people accountable and learn from it. And I hope you continue posting feedback, and like, we love your opinions on the books. I would just like, if you wouldn't mind leaving me out of it, I don't need your opinion on me, frankly. So lovely. So Tom, next month, what are we doing? Is it even more unhinged?
I don't think so. Oh, now, I will tell you, there's no like great stories in my motivation for picking this. I just looked at my to be read pile and I was like, oh, this looks like one that would be interesting to talk about. So sorry, there's no like generational backstory here. In fact, it's a fairly recent novel from a few years ago, and it was made into, I think, a mini series on Hulu or something. Oh. But we are going to be discussing the novel Little Fires Everywhere.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And you watched this miniseries?
I have not watched the miniseries. So this is my first. I had just heard of it. I picked the book up at a book sale, and it's from 2017. So it's almost about 10 years old, but that's, you know, recent enough, right? So yeah, Little Fires Everywhere. That's our next novel. And again, if you'd like to leave us feedback, you can email us, of course, and then Facebook. We do have a Blue Sky account, although I don't keep that up as much as I should. And we would love to hear what you have to say about anything. keep it, you know, as long as you're not personally attacking Stella, because that's my job. But no, really. Thank you as always. We'll see you next month, and thank you very much for listening, and take care.
And be sure to keep a soap bar at the ready so you can make a mold of a key and then whittle some wood.
And just don't eat powdered donuts.
Don't eat powdered donuts. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to put Dunkin's out of business.
Oh, Krispy Kreme is better anyway. Good night.
Goodbye. Do you remember Spud Nuts?
Oh, God, I miss Spud Nuts.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.